It is not human, but it is trained on the corpus of everything that humans know and do. So it looks like it, and it can help us become, I mean, it will be the ultimate irony, right? Can AI help us to become more human?
Welcome to Act in Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. There is no question today that new technology is changing the way we think about and experience work. Speculation abounds about how the rapid evolution of artificial intelligence and other disruptive technologies will affect the workplace. Worries about machines replacing human jobs are common. Others, however, are optimistic about the way AI is changing how we work, for they see AI as an important tool to promote better efficiency and productivity in the workplace. How will AI change the way that work is done? How will it affect the workforce? And how will it affect the economy? To answer some of these questions and more, today we're bringing you a panel discussion from our Business Matters 2024 conference. Acton's Director of Programs and Education, Dan Churchwell, leads Brent Urell, Mark Johnson, and Mate Zak in a conversation looking to the future of work and the role disruptive technology will play in it. If you'd like to view the entirety of the Business Matters 2024 conference, all the videos are available right now on Acton On Demand, the home for all the lectures, events, conferences, and programming Acton hosts year in and year out. You can sign up for free today at ondemand.acton.org. That's ondemand.acton.org. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Act in Line on our website at acton.org/actinline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Act in Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Our first panelist, Brent Urell, is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, specializing in job training and workforce development. Recently, he has focused on the workforce opportunities and challenges resulting from generative AI and automation, as well as strategies for improving economic mobility in rural, redeveloping, and non-metropolitan areas. Our second panelist, Mate Zak, is a proud Acton alumnus from the 2010 intern program and now works as the innovation lead for PricewaterhouseCoopers in Budapest, Hungary, where he drives local and regional innovation initiatives, including the recent implementation of an AI solution in the CEE region for tax and legal services. Our last panelist, Mark Johnson, is a co-founder and managing partner at Michigan Software Labs in Ada, Michigan. Michigan Software Labs is a technology company which develops custom software solutions, including apps and AI tools for Fortune 500 companies. The company was named as an Inc. 5000 fastest growing company and Fortune 100 best places to work in the USA. Mark is also a member of both the Forbes Technology Council and Fast Company Executive Board, where he writes articles for both publications. Our panel moderator is Dan Churchwell, who currently serves as the Director of Programs and Education for the Acton Institute. He is interdisciplinary in his interests and has taught and lectured widely on issues related to the intersection of philosophy, theology, and economics. His current research interests include media ecology, technological ethics, and the future of work.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Business Matters 2024. Less than 70 years ago, in 1956, the term artificial intelligence was first used in a paper at the Dartmouth Summer Institute. Many quality thinkers were sitting around trying to figure out what it is that they were developing and thinking through at that time. Much debate was had about what to call it. Some were saying genuine intelligence, but they finally settled on this idea of artificial intelligence. And at the time, the most advanced computers were less than a million times slower than the cell phone in your pocket. No matter where you fall or find yourself on the spectrum of techno-optimism or techno-pessimism, technology pervades the modern world. David Nye argued, in fact, in 1995, that technological progress is actually America's true civil religion. What advances we've had in those last 70 years. In 2022, we all know the phenomenon that hit November 30th when ChatGPT was first unleashed on the public just 14 months ago. In that same year, in 2022, IBM did a global survey, though, and found that 35% of companies already reported using AI in their business, and an additional 42% reported that they were already exploring how to use AI in the next fiscal year. Today, we have three very accomplished thinkers, practitioners on our panel today to discuss some of these questions and engage in this conversation. And please welcome Brent, Mark, and Mate. Welcome. We're absolutely delighted you're with us. And Brent, I want to start with you. Your expertise really is employment and workplace, workforce development. Recently, you wrote a piece about how artificial intelligence and soft skills in the modern workplace are a benefit in these scenarios. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these practical insights on soft skills and artificial intelligence?
Sure. And again, thank you so much for having me. This is a topic that I spend basically all the time these days thinking about, reading about, and trying to get my mind around the extent of the implications of artificial intelligence for employment. You've probably heard this quote before. It either comes from a guy by the name of Niels Bohr, who was a Nobel laureate physicist, or it comes from Yogi Berra. The quote is, predictions are hard, and they're especially hard when it comes to the future. And I think that more than anything sort of captures the challenge that we all face with the advent of generative AI as it begins to make its way into our workplaces and into our lives. I mean, I think it's very difficult to know and to be able to predict with any kind of specificity what the impacts are going to be. In the next week or two, I'll have a report out on that very topic, tracking the variation and the projections around AI from about 2005 to the present, and just how much variation there's been in terms of people trying to estimate the impacts of AI in employment and skills. I say all of that because I think that uncertainty is the main certainty that we're dealing with. We can be absolutely sure that in market economies, we're always going to see a lot of change. And I think that AI holds the potential to put that change cycle on high for everybody in terms of the need to be able to adapt to new technology, build new skills, and so on, in order to remain relevant in the workplace. And that's really where this conversation about soft skills starts. Soft skills, if you boil them down, are really about learning. Are you equipped to learn? And just to back up for a second, when we talk about soft skills, what we're talking about are things like teamwork, communication, flexibility, perseverance, also called GRIT in the literature on workforce development. Those things are essential both on the job, executing on tasks, and absolutely vital as to be a good learner. And we need to be thinking in both of those domains, that we are equipping people to do a good job by having these kinds of interpersonal skills that are so necessary in the job. We also need them to be good learners. And that's why I've spent so much time focusing on this in terms of the importance of soft skills relative to AI. The pace of change is going to require us not just to be good learners, but to be learning good learners all the time. And I really emphasize that with the young people that I work with as a scholar and as a supervisor. The time is now. You have to get into the realm of artificial intelligence, make yourself comfortable with its use, not avoid it, because it is not avoidable going into the future. So those are really the main two factors, I think, in terms of why we need to emphasize soft skills from both a practical standpoint and from a learning standpoint. Now, in terms of the way that AI itself can help us overcome some of these challenges, I should say, has been one of the big surprises to me thus far in the way the technology has developed. I think there's research to support this already, that AI may itself be the most important tool for learning how to use AI, and particularly for the populations that I'm most concerned about, which are disadvantaged and marginalized workers, in the way that AIs can serve as coaches to workers who may not have had all the skill development either in the technical domain or in the soft skills domain. And I think the other thing, the other big surprise learning that I've discovered as I've been studying this is this question of skills democratization. AI holds the capacity to allow people to skip through a whole bunch of tedious learning processes and acquire skills that might take them months or even years to acquire, and have an AI do that for them. I think about this a lot as somebody who works in a think tank. I've spent 30 years developing my reading, analytical, and writing skills in the policy domain. I think an AI for the next generation is going to allow people to skip a lot of that and be able to move much more quickly into higher levels of work, analysis, and writing than was available to people of my generation. So those are kind of the big thoughts that I have around AI and its application in the workforce and the application to education and training.
That's really great. I mean, do you think, I know you've written recently as well on the idea of the possibility of AI and automation driving a wedge between kind of making the elite more elite and the people who are on the bottom more marginalized. Do you find that AI and automation, do you fear maybe as we're talking about predictions, where are you, where do you think that falls within the wedge of does AI and automation create that divide?
Well, as I alluded to at the end of my introduction there, I think that that's possible, right? There are all sorts of possibilities. And as we talked about, you know, predictions are hard, particularly relating to the future. We don't really know what the impacts are going to be. I don't think they're going to either be our worst fears or our fondest hopes. I think it's going to be a muddle of opportunities and challenges that people face. The initial data on this is quite encouraging to me in the way that AI can help to level up the workforce and allow, like I was just talking about, allow workers to gain access to skills that would otherwise require so much additional training and so much additional education, but they may be able to bypass that. And the AI becomes kind of an adaptive tool that allows people to do more than they ever imagined that they could do. So, and I think that in terms of the wage question, you know, how is this going to affect less skilled versus more skilled? Very interesting study just came out in the last few weeks where the researchers, they're at the University of Toronto or Ontario, I can't remember which right now, but these researchers looked at the way that AI could democratize skill. And the examples that they use relative to that are two quite disparate ones, but they talk about cab drivers in the UK who, for those who aren't familiar, in the past, you know, it could take you 4 years of intense study of the medieval street system of London in order to become qualified as a cab driver. So you have all that, you had to study and absorb all of this information and take that on board, pass extensive examinations, and then you got your license. GPS has completely turned that on its head, and a GPS is a form of artificial intelligence. Now, anybody can do like what London cabbies have done for forever, but they don't have to go through all that 4 years of training. Another example that they use in this, the researchers use in the study, is in healthcare, where, you know, to become a doctor in this country, you've got undergrad, you've got med school, then you've got various layers of post med school education in order to become a practitioner who can work on their own or has admitting privileges in a hospital, for instance. AI, the researchers were in the study were talking about, AI can equip people with all of that knowledge and skill that's required to make differential diagnoses without having to go through the entire medical school process to get there. So what we could see are, rather than seeing a doctor, and this is already happening, at least it's happening to me, it's a nurse practitioner who has access to a tremendous amount of diagnostic capability through computers and through AIs that can help sort through symptoms and make recommendations about treatment. Now, that doesn't mean that the role of the physician disappears, but what it does mean is that we will be able to radically expand the supply of healthcare workers through the use of AI, which we desperately need to do because we have an aging population and we have a plethora of new technologies and new treatments coming on board, becoming available to the public. And we need more healthcare workers than we're going to be able to create, more doctors in particular than we're going to be able to train. So AI, in a way, can help us to solve some of our demographic problems and our skill development problems. And so you were talking at the beginning, I'm definitely on the optimistic side of this. I think that AI is going to be a huge boon to people, and not something that people should be afraid of.
Thank you, Brent. What I'm hearing, Brent, from you is that essentially training is going to be a big piece in the future, whether it's organizations or universities or some sort of certificates that people can get so that they're up to date on these new technologies. Mate, did you have a question?
Yeah, that's right, because what Brent said was pretty intriguing, because I'm coming from more of the practical side of things, how to actually launch an AI tool, how to plan for it, how to build a business case, how to launch it, change management, etc. But the effects are really beyond my comprehension. And now that you are talking about trainings and upskilling. What we're seeing right now globally, for example, within the accounting and tax industries, audit industries, is that the shape of the organization is shifting. Simplistically said, from a triangular to a diamond shape. So less and less people are coming in from lower grades and maturing to higher grades. And the uncertainty or question that I have here, how I can relate to what you said, is, you know, how are people going to get the right experience as AI develops, it tackles issues from the more simplistic to the more advanced ones. So if we're substituting AI and LLM solutions with the lower level tasks, how is a corporation going to tackle the experience issue? What is your take on that?
All of these questions are quite complex, and I think we're going to be kind of feeling our way forward into it to figure it out. I'm very grateful that there are organizations like PwC whose job it is to help businesses sort through these questions and try to develop the strategies for coping with them. I mean, I would say in general, if you look at the way that AI is expected to affect the workforce, it's very different than any other sort of chapter of automation that we've ever experienced in the past. In the past, it's always been the less educated and less skilled who have been the ones who have seen their jobs most affected by the introduction of new technologies, right? We saw it in the shift from agrarian to industrial, from industrial to information and services. You know, there's always been such a premium on more education, more skills. And what's so interesting to me about AI is that, again, at least the preliminary results of what's going on out there suggest that it's actually people who have more education who are more exposed to the effects of AI, right? It's the lawyers and the accountants and people in advertising and marketing and human resources. These are people that have invested a lot in their education, typically many years. And all of a sudden, they're the ones who are feeling the kind of the pressure to change, right? Because so much of what they do can be automated. About 20% of jobs, and these skew toward the high end of the labor market, about 20% of the jobs will see, you know, a significant amount of impact from automation. People with less education that are more involved in processes and tasks that are more manualized in their nature see much less impact from AI. So this is a complete inversion from what we've seen in terms of automation in the past. And it's going to be very interesting. And we live in interesting times, whether that's a blessing or a curse, we live in interesting times. It's going to be very interesting to see how people who have never really experienced that kind of pressure from automation respond. And knowledge businesses, that are focused, that are in the knowledge economy, are the ones who are at the leading edge of this, because generative AI programs are especially good with language. And language has always been the thing that has been hardest to automate at language-based activities. So, we don't know. Nobody knows. Anybody who tells you that they know what's going to happen, I think, is you know, they're trying to sell you something that may not be in your interest. But what we need to be building into our workforce in the face of all of that change is flexibility. How do you pivot to new opportunities? We are not ever going to run out of work. I think that's what one of the most important things to keep in mind is that automation does is generate its own demand, right? We increase automation, we get wealthier, people have more money, they spend more money. All of a sudden, they're buying things that they regard as necessities that never existed before they had the money to buy them. So that's going to generate more jobs over time. The question is, how do you manage the transition between the old jobs and the new jobs? And that is going to be a task for everyone. It's going to be a task for business. It's going to be a task for education. And frankly, it's going to be a task for workers. Nobody can deliver this to you. You've got to go out and begin to make your own plan for how you're going to adjust to the new economy.
One of the important distinctions I think you're making there, too, is that we have to be careful when we say jobs are going away. It's largely tasks within jobs. And so the modification, you know, the sky is falling, people try to tell us all these jobs are going away. But I think we're seeing a lot of the modification is in specific tasks within industries that are more attuned to maybe some of this disruption. But Mark, let's turn to you, Mark. Your company, Michigan Software Labs, I mean, has just exploded over the last 14 years, really doing great work. You work with clients around the country to design and create the software and the apps that run some of these modern things we're talking about. I mean, how has AI or the conversation around AI and automation affected the business you're in?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be serving along this panel with all these other panelists. And I think if I could just take you a bit into the boardroom at what's happening and, you know, maybe just think about, you know, yourself in a boardroom of a Fortune 500 company and kind of get a flavor of what's happening. And if you were to back up, you know, 5 years or so, a lot of what they were talking about is using AI to really automate, you know, pricing. How can we start and make sure that we have, you know, of all of our SKUs have the best pricing along with that based on the supply and demand for our products or services? And then it shifted from just looking at pricing to looking at a recommendation engine. All right, now that we've got the right prices set, how can we make sure that we're recommending, you know, the right products? And so, you know, you've seen this before. You've been on Amazon, you go down to the bottom and it said, you know, here's all the other stuff that similar people, you know, bought after they bought that. So you end up putting more in your cart than you expected because, you know, that's how recommendation engines work. They're kind of reading your mind. Now what's happening in the boardroom is AI really has a seat at the table. And so there's a chair there for AI. And businesses that are leading and are starting to think about, all right, what is AI's role within our enterprise? And they're asking AI, you know, should we build this new factory or should we create this new product line? And it's really starting out in four categories, at least that we're seeing. One is it's starting out with a core business of, you know, how can we really take our, you know, core business and increase the revenue out of that? And within that, you know, how can we, of course, reduce costs to our core business? How can we also create new businesses that are outside of that, as well as these AI offerings or insights? And so starting to see a little bit of more adoption within that, but it's been happening over the past few years. And so I think ChatGPT and other tools, you know, really made it public and made it something that people could commercially understand. But now it's been happening within enterprise for, you know, five years or so. And so just something that we've been seeing, and I wanted to take you into the boardroom a little bit of what we've been learning and what we've been hearing.
That's really great. I mean, when you're developing these apps and some of this software, are your clients looking for, it's probably broad, but are they looking for specific kinds of applications for these artificial intelligence? I mean, when we say artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky called this a suitcase word, right? Our artificial intelligence needs to be unpacked because there's so much there. You know, what exactly are we talking about? Can you give us like a concrete example maybe, or in a generalized way, of some of your clients and what they're looking for with artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so it's adapted over time. Of course, it started with those three areas of, you know, pricing and recommendation, and then, you know, more of a seat at the table. Now within the applications, they really need it to be more intuitive. And so a lot of times as a user, you might not even know that AI is happening in the background of an application, but it's happening, it's there. It's making, you know, the information that you see, the data that you see on the application a lot more, you know, available to you. And really that next action that you're looking to take is already presented there. And so we don't know really that it's happening behind the scenes, but it is happening. And so a lot of our clients, especially in the enterprise, they're using it really to try and scale. You know, how can we make sure we're not having any redundant or, you know, useless information up on the screen, and make sure it's the best value that we can provide the business is right there in front of the user. So for example, yesterday, we were with a group. This is a, you know, healthcare group, but they're actually using AI in order to provide the right recommended medicine, and being able to partner along with a physician and an expert in order to make the appropriate recommendation. Again, this is in cancer research and diagnosis. And combining the AI with a human, an expert, that's really going to have the best impact, and at least in terms of what we're seeing. I think, you know, of course there's ethical concerns with that, but a lot of the best, you know, research that we've heard is you want to treat AI like a work colleague. And so a work colleague is someone that you're learning from and they're learning from you, and, you know, they're a bit of a threat. They could get promoted before you, but you really want to think about them as someone that's helping you along the way. You're going to be able to help them and, you know, not just, you know, totally turn them off, because I think what we want to make sure we're doing is enterprises are, you know, as growing and adopting these new technologies, are really thinking about this as even more powerful than the internet. And you remember the, you know, the switch, you know, before, if, you know, businesses said, you know, hey, we only accept faxes, that's how we're going to do our orders, we're not going to accept any email. I mean, you know, they're not going to survive. They're not going to last, you know. We're even thinking about Blockbuster and larger enterprises, you know, versus Netflix. All right, we're going to, you know, totally disrupt your business model. And with Blockbuster, what's interesting is, you know, they really didn't want to disrupt those late fees, because that's how they made 70% of their revenue, is with, you know, people were, you know, not taking their DVDs back in time. And so the same sort of thing is happening right now in the enterprise in a different way, but with AI. And so we're continuing to see it really as it affects the core business.
That's fascinating. So that this idea is of AI as colleague. Let me pause there just for a minute. So when, you know, I have colleagues here, some are watching this as we're recording, and we have really great interactions. We know a little bit about each other's families, our quirks, and said, you know, there's knowledge to be had about who we are, our personalities, et cetera. Well, one thing that makes Acton unique is that we really highly value what it means to be embodied. We're embodied persons, we're rational beings. You know, what does it mean to be human, truly human? You know, we talk a lot about here at Acton. And so when you use that analogy of AI as colleague, sometimes, you know, artificial intelligence seems like magic when people are describing it. I mean, you really can't know it in a way that you would know a colleague. So how beneficial do you think, or how, or what are the areas, the fringes, the margins around treating AI as a colleague in that relationship to language as we normally use it?
That's a really interesting question. I'm curious the other panelists, but I'll just share one comment of, you know, as you think about the difference between, you know, knowledge and wisdom, you know, you can have a colleague that is really smart, they know all the facts and they can memorize everything, but they don't know really how to apply that knowledge in the right way. A lot of the same is true, you know, with AI, is it's going to know everything and it's going to have all the facts and figures about your enterprise, but is it going to know the right thing to do, you know, when maybe the rules don't apply? And so I think you saw this a little bit with chess early on, as they were applying AM models to chess, and chess was doing things. Originally they built the models to really copy, you know, the best chess players in the world. And then what they found is that if they just told the AI the rules and allowed it to innovate on its own, you know, knowing, rewarding it for wins and, you know, not rewarding it for losses, what they found is that it was doing things that humans had never really even considered, like sacrificing the queen in certain areas, because it was able to think through all these permutations. And so I think about this as it relates to your work colleague, is the difference between knowledge and wisdom. You know, someone that has all the knowledge but maybe doesn't know how to apply it. And those are just some thoughts, but I'm really curious what everyone's thinking.
Yeah, that's great. Anybody else want to jump into that?
Yeah, I definitely have something, but I want to give Mate a chance to get in here, too, if he's got something he wants to say.
Okay, well, let's circle back to that AI as colleague. That's a really interesting thing. Mate, thank you for joining us all the way from Hungary. We're delighted to have you. Can you describe a little bit about your role at PwC, especially where it relates to the innovation side of your work?
Well, thanks, Dan, and thank you for having me. Myself as innovation leader locally in PwC, Hungary, based in Budapest, I have many hats, but one of the key ones is I'm operating an internal incubation process and an incubation house, if you will, and I'm also supporting innovative solutions to become reality. Should it be for internal purposes or for external purposes towards our clients? And AI came into my focus like a year ago when globally PwC, we announced that we're investing a large amount of money in AI. And as part of that, as a key initiative, we went into an exclusive contract with Harvey, and right now, just a couple of months ago, here locally in the CEE region, I was a part of the team which launched the tool for tax and legal AI.
So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, as far as I could tell in my research, that Harvey is a second company, or is a company, correct, that you're partnering with? Is that right?
Exactly. It's an external company. If you want to go into a little bit of detail, they're building their tool on top of the OpenAI ChatGPT solution. AI is an interesting phenomenon because technologically we're speaking about many technologies coming together. So as Mark already gave very good examples of AI being used even decades ago for multiple purposes, from recommendation engines to pricing, whatnot. I think the value add that came, or the most recent innovation that came in, was the combination of AI with large language models, which really made the difference between, you know, a machine, a technology, and a colleague, if you will. And I think that is the key difference there, and that is driving all the hype really around recent developments in AI.
Yeah, and Harvey is essentially helping PwC with a lot of legal, and it was interesting. Try to be very clear that it's not replacing lawyers or consultants, but it is doing something. But the something was kind of vague. So can you give us, without, you know, giving us proprietary, like, what is it helping PwC do?
Absolutely. So as of the current state of the technology, we are seeing AI supporting our tax and legal work in many ways. Just to name a couple of them. Contract analysis, regulatory compliance, due diligence projects, basically streamlining all the legal work that is being done, ultimately providing our colleagues and our clients more opportunities to focus on the value add part of their work.
Okay. No, that's really fascinating that it, and that's part of open AI. Is it a part of an open, it's using the open AI sourceware, is that right?
The language engine, yes.
Yeah.
Language engine, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I'd like to just come back to that colleague question that we've been talking about, AI as a colleague. I think that you're hearing this. You've now heard it from both Mark and from Mate, and that is completely consistent with what I see happening in the research around this. There's a very interesting study done by Eric Brynjolfsson out of Stanford University last year, and it was focused on call center workers, and it was a large software firm. that employed about 5,000 call center customer service representatives. That's hard work, as we know, to be on the phone all the time, dealing with customers who are in various states of kind of dissatisfaction, typically, with the service that they're receiving. And they have a problem and they need a solution. In this study, they had, as I said, about 5,000 workers, and they split them in half. Half got a chatbot, large language model, program assistant, and half didn't. And what they found was really, really interesting, was that it was the lowest skilled workers who benefited the most from having access to this chatbot. It allowed them to much more quickly onboard as workers, because they had a coach there with them all the time, helping them sort through the responses that they needed to make to the customer. And the responses were both on the technical side. You know, there is this issue that I'm having with the service that I purchased that isn't working and I want it fixed. So that's sort of one set of issues. But the other part of this is that the chatbot was very helpful in helping workers deal with the kind of socio-emotional content of the call. Somebody calls in, they're saying, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I am outraged by, you know, how bad this program is. The chatbot was also helping these workers adjust their language to address kind of the emotional context of their responses, you know, to be more empathetic, which is interesting, right? We need a machine that can help us become more empathetic. And what they've got out of this was a really large increase in productivity, about 14% improvement in productivity overall. And for those workers, the new workers, the less skilled workers, it was much more than that, right? Those kinds of productivity increases are very difficult to get. And for many years, there was a fellow by the name of Michael Polanyi who argued that it was basically impossible to teach people that kind of tacit, implied knowledge that goes along that the interpersonal skills. And the AI is actually able to do that. Now, that's a huge change, enormous change. It's going to work its way through our economy to increase the productivity of all kinds of service-based work, which is, in the United States, 80% of the U.S. economy is services.
That's really interesting. So are you saying, in your opinion, do you think AI has solved Polanyi's paradox?
I believe that it holds the potential for dealing with that, beginning to give us a solution. We've never had one before. And I think it holds the potential for doing that. Now, so we asked the question you were asking, you know, Acton cares about this embodiedness and the human source of all of this value. Well, the large language model doesn't learn on its own. It is trained on the transcripts of calls with the highest performing customer service representatives. That's how it learns. It's still human. These are still human responses. They're just encoded in a database that other people who have not had the opportunity for one reason or another to be able to learn those skills the way the rest of us learn those skills. Now, that can be an organic problem, something like autism. I've got a son with autism. I'm very excited about the potential of this technology to help him decode the world. He has a problem reading social cues. Could AI models help him learn how to understand those social cues better? Or if you have been a person who's been exposed to a lot of trauma in your life, you may have developed bad reflexes, bad social emotional reflexes to conflict. This kind of coaching can help people adjust their responses to the world. So we need to remember that while this is electronics and it's microchips and it's not human, right? It is not human, but it is trained on the corpus of everything that humans know and do. So it looks like it,
right?
Right? And it can help us become, I mean, it will be the ultimate irony, right? Can AI help us to become more human?
That is, I think, a $1 million or maybe $1 trillion question that a lot of people are trying to think through. And all of these conversations, your initial answers to the questions bring me to this idea of, you know, several years ago, the World Economic Forum in a lecture there, someone argued that we're in the cusp of a fourth industrial revolution. And the reason that it's distinct from the other three is that it's combining so many, the biological, the technical, all these spheres. So you have biotech in a way that we haven't had in the past, and it's across the globe. It's not just certain sectors or certain countries. And so this idea, whether it's true or not, or a good analogy, this fourth industrial revolution, do you think, and to all three of you, are there any industries that might be immune from this? Or will AI or these kinds of technologies eventually affect every form of vocation that we know of?
Yeah, I guess I could jump into that, you know, just at a high level. You know, really no one is safe. You know, originally, you know, like we were talking about before, I think Brent mentioned, you know, we thought that the knowledge workers were going to be the safe ones. And now, you know, the front lines were going to be the ones that were most disrupted. And it's really not. It's going to be everyone. I think even software development, you know, we're in the custom software development, you know, organization and industry. And, you know, tools are already learning how to program. And again, they're not as good as, you know, humans are right now. But we said that about chess, you know, we've said that about all these things. But I always like to say, you know, we get this question a lot, like, what's the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning? And if I can just, you know, kind of explain that a little bit, because the heading really is artificial intelligence. And that's what we were talking about. It's the practice of getting machines to, you know, really mimic humans, be able to think like us. And then the subheading of that is machine learning. That's just a type of artificial intelligence. So that's where we're developing those machine learning models to really learn about what's next and what's best. But, you know, a lot of people get those confused and they're trying to think, is this the same thing? And it's really not. You know, you've got artificial intelligence as the heading, you've got machine learning is really that subheading that's a type there. But I'm really curious, as we're talking, if the other panelists think, you know, no one's disruptable or if there's a safe industry out there.
It's really hard to give predictions on what's coming up next, because, you know, traditionally the human mind, as it works, if you want to give a prediction, you look at where you are right now, you look at yesterday and the day before, you put a near linear trend on it, and there you have your prediction on the future. And especially with AI and the speed of technological change, the linear thinking might not be the right way to extrapolate and to give predictions. What I can add to this is the issues that we're facing right now, because right now we are testing and experimenting with you know, how far we can get with AI, using AI in tax and legal. And it's like a roller coaster, really. Sometimes all the colleagues are baffled by, you know, how dumb response is that's coming from it. And time to time, they come with amazement and say, wow, the model and the response is a perfect analysis of this or that legal or tax question. Now, the key difference that there is right now between the AI colleague and the real colleague is the level of dependability and the reliability on the answer. So as Brent said, in the call centers, suggestions are coming from the past experiences and past facts, recordings of previous conversations. Now, the question is, do we have the right set of input data that we're training the model on? Is it skewed? Is it biased? Is it up to date? Is the content right? And these are the challenges that we are trying to sort out and looking for, you know, how to sort it out. Because if you're head of a finance or tax department of a company and you go and try to rely on a tax advice coming from a large language model or AI, who is going to ensure that response is up to date? Even if it sounds correct, it just might be that it was up to date 3 months ago and not right now. And this is really what I see a key challenge. And maybe this brings us back to the question of what you said then about what is human and what is not human. Is a machine human if it can mimic human activities? Does it have the Chinese room experiment? Does it have the means to create responses that appear human? Does it have the decision-making power, and does it have the will to ask questions and set out goals?
Yeah, that's good. I think, Mate, you have a really good point. You know, and there's artificial intelligence, and then sometimes AGI gets mixed in, you know, artificial general intelligence. So that would be more of a mind that some people allude to. Is that possible? And there's wide debate whether AGI is, you know, is it really a mind, or is it some sort of intensive search engine with learning capabilities? And there's much, and in the literature, I think people are talking, this is near-termers or long-termers. So the near-termers are thinking about what is going on right in front of us, right? And you as practitioners, et cetera, a lot of us think near-term. And then there's some meddlers that are, you know, more thinking long-term about what, you know, possibilities. Because just in the news, if you pay attention to the news, in the last 2 or 3 months, we've had, you know, the issue of the legal standing. I believe it was, I don't think it was in front of the Supreme Court, but somebody had done a search using AI, and it made up bogus cases in a very highly publicized political legal trial here in America. And then just a month or two before that, we had autonomous drone war game where it was published like it was real, and they retracted that. But if you remember this, just several months ago, the autonomous drone using AI realized the quickest way to eliminate issues within its software was to send a missile into who was using the human backup. It realized, and it missiled, it hellfired the actual people that were controlling the back end of the autonomous warships.
So just to clarify that's a that actually did
exactly
not happen. That was a simulation.
It was a war game, a simulation. Yeah, and so yeah. When they published that would happen, you know, it those kinds of things make the news, right? So you have these techno optimists versus techno pessimist flavors, whether it's near-termer or long-termer. But what I'm hearing, and for those of, I know you gentlemen know that we have many watch parties listening. There are hundreds of college students right now watching this. There are multiple businesses doing watch parties, you know, where their organizations are listening to this. And I'm hearing a lot about training, but I'm hearing also philosophically a lot of, well, we don't know fully, or we do, you know. So help me think through, maybe Mark, if you would be able to take this, you know, internally, how does your own team deal with this or consult with your clients about, you know, not only solving their problem, but is there a way of thinking of maybe even medium term? Long term might be impossible, but how do you help on more the philosophical side, like thinking through the implications of doing this for your business? Is that even part of the business planning or process?
Yeah, certainly. We, you know, as we kind of look at the progression here, you know, a lot of it might come, you know, a lot sooner than we think, but we kind of have the milestone of around 2030, where a lot of some of the, you know, the innovations that, you know, everyone was looking forward to are really going to actually come to, into effect. And so, you know, for us, you know, there's some things that are coming out, which really augment the, you know, human intelligence. So they're doing some things at MIT labs. You've probably seen this device that they have that can study your speech patterns. And so it's essentially learning how your tongue pattern's working. And then you're able to actually communicate with the internet without actually talking. And so I could have a conversation with you, send you a text message or send you an email without ever opening my mouth. And as they move up into, you know, more of a digital channel and being able to actually, you know, access the APIs of the brain and being able to connect that, we'll actually be able to communicate, not with me actually moving my mouth, but just thinking. And it's going to happen. We don't know if it's going to be 2030 or when that next milestone is going to be. But, you know, really allowing, you know, humans in terms of this next thing, and it'll be a decision point for us all. We're going to have to decide, all right, do I want the upgrade, or do I want to, you know, kind of stay, you know, who I am, you know, or do I want to put my memory somewhere? And all these, you know, things are very ethical, you know, concerns. But for businesses that are trying to innovate, you know, where is this, you know, going to happen? Where is this going to go next? We really see this being, you know, even though it's been a great innovation to have a smartphone, this is really more of an analog way of interacting with the internet. Eventually, it's going to be a lot more connected to who we are. And so you're starting to see, you know, different companies coming out with all these new products. And that's a lot of where it's going. It's going to shorten the ability for you to get this knowledge, get this data that you need in order to make a decision.
So if I could amplify on that just a little bit, I agree with all of that. And I think that when it comes to AI, we always have to have kind of the magic asterisks next to whatever we say about it. That it's not happening now, it does not mean that it cannot happen, right? It's this technology is going to surprise us in ways that are just, you know, unforeseeable. Most of that is going to be quite positive, I think. There will be challenges. There will be these ethical questions that have to be sorted through, and people will have to make decisions for themselves, and companies are going to have to make decisions. I think that the other thing we have to grapple with is that it's not only unpredictable, as Mate said, it's nonlinear. In the way that it's going to happen. This is not, we cannot project based on recent past and present what the future could look like. And in fact, one of the things that I frequently think about is how these technologies are going to recombine. Human beings produce narrow technologies to do a narrow thing, to address a narrow question. And then other human beings take that and they combine it with their idea. And other people take that third idea and connect it to a fourth idea. And there's a kind of exponential and very unpredictable growth pathway that goes along, that goes on in here. So I think that recombinant process of this technology is extremely important. And I'll just add one more layer to this, which is what Mark pointed to earlier when it came to chess and Go, and the way that the technology actually begins to identify pathways of action that have never occurred to us, that it becomes its own innovation source. And that is another sort of level of complexity that human beings are going to have to grapple with, is that it's going to be beyond anybody's either ability to predict or control.
And that is an interesting question, especially for those people listening. You know, I'm reminded of Roy Amara, the futurist, who, he's known for Amara's law, that we tend to overestimate the effect of a technology in the short term, but underestimate the effect of a technology in the long term. And it's hard to, in the short term, the world we're living in right in front of our faces is sometimes frictionless. Economics makes it we want it to be as easy as possible to do these things. And, the movie Oppenheimer, bestseller, or best actor and best picture here recently, shows the effects of technology and thinking through some of the after effects are largely difficult of what may be some of those effects. And so you guys have brought to mind really some fantastic things. What I heard is largely thinking about for corporations and organizations, what does training look like? What does training, moving from more the diamond model or the pyramid model to the diamond model, as Mate said, Brent, what you were arguing for, thinking through about even for neurodivergent people or thinking through soft skills, how it might help those on the lower rungs. And then Mark, your fascinating work you're doing of thinking through what are the boardroom, what is AI as colleague? Where does AI sit in the boardroom in reality? You're already seeing it in the work and the clients that you're working with currently. So this topic is wide-ranging. I know we wouldn't solve it in 60 minutes, but thank you for thinking through practically some of these ideas and giving some insight of how AI is being used currently and how it might be used in the near future. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Acton Line, I'm Eric Cohn.